Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Hi, I'm Carrie Miller. Thanks for listening to our podcast. We're in our fall member drive right now, which means we're listening back to some of our favorite conversations of the year. Listeners like you make our program possible. Our show and many others on NPR wouldn't be possible without the support of listeners like you, no matter where you live. You can donate now at nprnews.org. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm John Wanamaker. Jurors in the manslaughter trial of St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez asked a judge today if Yanez's entire testimony could be read back to them. The judge rejected the request and sent them back to deliberate. The jury has been deliberating since Monday afternoon over charges tied to Yanez's shooting of Philando Castile during a traffic stop last July. DFL delegates will meet in St. Paul this weekend to see if they can decide on a favorite candidate for mayor. The party's city convention is scheduled to kick off tomorrow morning and will feature four contenders hoping to win an endorsement. Former city council members Pat Harris and Melvin Carter, council member Dai Tao, and former school board member Tom Goldstein have been contending for the party's blessing. University of Minnesota political scientist Larry Jacobs says that, like in Minneapolis, St. Paul's dominant DFL may struggle to reach a consensus.
There are real divisions. You've got a pretty strong group of Hmong voters that are now pretty well organized. You've got the parish system under the Catholic Church. You've got progressives, and you've got still other factions. And so the party is really struggling to bring coherence to this tremendous variety of interests and organizations.
About 500 delegates are expected for the convention. Minnesota has joined a national investigation of drug makers to determine their role in the opioid epidemic. Emma Sapong has more.
Attorney General Lori Swanson is participating with a bipartisan group of state attorneys general investigating pharmaceutical companies. Swanson says they're looking into the potential culpability of drug makers in their marketing and sale of opioid prescription painkillers. Her office notes that sales and overdoses of prescription opioids have quadrupled since 1999. A pharmaceutical trade organization declined to comment, but the group's website says the industry is, quote, committed to working collectively to prevent the misuse, abuse, and diversion of prescription medicines. Opioid deaths in Minnesota have climbed steadily since 1999, reaching 338 in 2015. Emma Sapong, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Cloudy, 75 degrees in the Twin Cities. This is Minnesota Public Radio News. The time, 10:06.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. This hour, why communicating with our doctors is a lot more complicated than it seems. I asked two physicians and an experienced storyteller to read Dr. Danielle Ofri's new book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. Dr. Ofri argues that while medicine is practiced today with highly advanced technology, transparent and empathetic communication between the patient and the doctor is still the cornerstone of the relationship. So as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you on social media. When you see your doctor, do you feel like you have his or her full attention? If you were going to give some constructive criticism to your doctor about communication, what would you say? Talk to me about that on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dr. Renee Critchlow is a family physician and an assistant professor in the family medicine department at the U of M. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Carrie.
Dr. Amin Ramatula is a cardiologist and director of the Heart Failure Program at Metropolitan Heart and Vascular Consultants. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie, for having me.
And Syl Jones is a writer, playwright, and resident fellow of narrative medicine at HCMC. Syl, really good to have you back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Dr. Critchlow, I know how challenging it is to be a truly engaged listener. It's the thing that I do every day. I'm surprised how many doctors don't realize how essential that is. Why?
Well, Carrie, one of the biggest things is the training for medicine. You have to think about people who, since they were in kindergarten, have been gunning and gearing up to get into medical school. They've rewarded by having excellent grades. They're rewarded by doing multiple things all at the same time. And they're rewarded by grades. And this is the system that they are locked into 20 years. And they get into medical school, and they want to do their best. And they're told that being the best means, again, making good grades and learning all about the Krebs cycle and learning all about beta blockers and learning all about. And very often in the past, the relationship developing between a doctor and the patient is thrown in as an afterthought.
Wow.
A lot of times in your first year of medical school, they'll start talking to you about how to relate and discuss with the patient. But at the same time, you're having some of your most hard classes that you've had in your entire life. You're doing biochem, you're doing pathology. You've never been challenged like you have intellectually before. And they're sort of slipping in, oh, and by the way, you need to talk to people.
Still, you're nodding about that, right?
That's true.
This is like the last second thought here. It is not primary in a lot of medical school training.
Well, there's a wonderful piece called The Devil in the Third Year. I don't know if you guys have read that piece mm-hmm. about what happens in medical school. Just at the time when patients really, or physicians really should be thinking about, gee, I'm going to have to be really empathetic with patients. It's in that third year that they're given all kinds of other things. There's an onslaught of all kinds of other information. And they're basically not trained at that point to engage with, in terms of empathy, finding their connection with patients. And some of them, I've heard them tell me in classes at HCMC that they've been told by their teachers that they basically should have an arm's length relationship with the patient.
Wow. Dr. Amatullah, were you told that?
You know, I would totally agree with that. And I think there is a clear disconnect between the IQ and the EQ. I think yep. the medical school clearly emphasizes on how intelligent you are, what your grades are, starting right, as Renee said, right mm-hmm. from high school onwards, is what's your GPA, what's your score, and who's going to up each other in the medical school. But what is really not distilled very well is what's your emotional intelligence or your quotient.
You know, it's interesting you'd say that, because I think if you asked most patients, they'd say, I want a highly competent doctor. Obviously, I want the guy or girl that got the really good grades, but I also want somebody that I can talk to and who I sense isn't just listening, but is listening with compassion and empathy,
yeah.
which is a harder reach.
And those things are not mutually exclusive. I think that's one of the things that we have to really get into both patients' and physicians' minds. You can be someone who is quite competent, quite capable as a physician, but if you're not able to understand where the patient's coming from, if you're not able to elicit their story, then you actually are defeating your own intellect because you won't be able to apply it appropriately. If I don't find out what's actually going on with this patient, if they don't tell me their complete story, I may make assumptions that drive us down a totally different diagnostic pathway.
Mm-hmm.
So they complement each other very much. They're very much synergistic, and they're important that we use them together. One of the things I think that we need to sort of hit on is that there's a lot of things that go on in medical school, but where we do the kind of training that brings out EQ is in residency training. So the University of Minnesota Department of Family Medicine has been training docs in this state for 40 years. One of the things that we do, Carrie, after you graduate from medical school, you're a doctor, but you don't have a specialty.
Uh-huh.
You have to go off to a residency. We have 8 residencies in the University of Minnesota that are family medicine alone. We train half the family medicine doctors in the entire state. One of the things that we do is we do things like video reviews. If you're one of my interns, within the first week of you coming in, we sit you down with one of your patients and we video how you interact with them.
Wow.
And we have them learn how to ask, repeatedly learn how to ask open-ended questions. We have them learn how to elicit the patient's story. We have them learn how to set a clear agenda so that both the doctor's intentions and the patient's intentions are merged before they even go into the rest of it.
So you are trying to address this in medical schools now.
There's more space in residency to be able to do this. As a medical student, you don't have your own panel of patients. You don't have people that you're going to be following for 3 years.
Right.
But in residency is where you really get this kind of training. And our department is very intentional in making sure that our graduates go out with the ability to understand how to do this. But then we dump them into this malfunctioning system.
What they've learned.
The patient and the doctor really, I think, want to communicate. But then you put them in a system where I have graduates who go off and have to see patients every 15 minutes.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, think about how that's going to affect someone's ability to tell a story.
Let me ask you, are first names all right with you now that we've
established? Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, this is the thing that I found interesting about what Dr. Ofri said about how the listening shapes the narrative of the patient. This is something I know Syl will weigh in on,
absolutely,
too. Is that something it took you a while to be aware of, that the way you would listen to how the patient was talking to you was going to actually affect the story they were going to tell you about their health?
It is so true. You know, it just depends upon how open you are in terms of questioning, what kind of an open-ended questions you would basically set out for the patients. You can direct their narratives as quickly and as deviously as you would like.
Give
or
me an
as
example.
Open-ended.
What do you mean by that?
You know, it's interesting, but as specialists, it is, it's one of those things that you sort of walk in with a preconceived notion or an idea. Whenever I sort of get in to see a new patient in the clinic, the obvious temptation is, here's the age, here's the gender, here's the risk factors, here's the complaint. I think that's what it is. You're pretty much walking into the room with three or four preconceived ideas or notions. Then what happens? The wrong track that you're going to go down is, of course, you know that you have 20 minutes to deal with this. You're going to have to nail down the next three or four diagnoses. You can direct the patient to fit in those preconceived ideas in the next 15 minutes, or you could be completely going in there unbiased, have some open-ended questions, and let the patient come out with their own narratives. And I can go into gazillion examples of these things that happen every day.
You know what this sounds like? This sounds like confirmation bias, which we're reading a lot about in politics,
yeah,
too.
That's exactly right. You know, the other thing that we're focused on, the patient's story and telling the patient's story. But we really need to think about what the physician's story is, too. What is the provider's story as they walk into the room?
I've never thought of that.
It's very important.
Why?
It's very important because the provider's story actually can shape some of the questions that he or she is asking. And also, as you said, the preconceived notions that you have, sometimes they can come from, well, usually they come from your past experience, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But that may not be appropriate for that particular patient. So we really, one of the things that I'm teaching patients to do is to really look at and probe what the physician's story is. Because if you don't do that, you may not understand where that person is coming from.
Okay, so what do I need to know about Renee as my physician that would shape the kind of communication that we're going to have?
Well, you probably need to know, I think, Renee, where you went to school and what your experience has been, and maybe even some things about your childhood. I remember, for example, in the book that we've just been talking about, basically there was a story about a guy who was hounding a patient who was a diabetic. Right,
right. Yeah.
But the Dr. Ofri gives us a good background on that doctor and where that doctor came from. That doctor had spent a lot of time in the Dominican Republic, had been trying hard to help people who were poor understand the nature of their illness and their disease. And he was using those same techniques with a person who really did understand all of that. And so that was the wrong technique to use. But it's helpful to know this is where he came from. This is how he thought he was going to practice the best kind of medicine.
Renee, what do you think of that?
When you're in the situation, for us, when we teach, when I'm talking with interns or residents, I think that you're absolutely right, Syl. One of the biggest things we do for them is you have to understand where you're coming from. One of the icebreakers that we use is, what was the home remedy that your grandma or mom would always bring up? And everyone has some variation of citrus, sugar, honey, and booze. Some variation
works
of that.
Works for everything.
When they share their stories about those kinds of things, they're like, oh, wait, when our patients come in and they express the way they do home remedies, you know, that comes from their family and their culture.
So that's telling you something about their background, right?
Yeah. And it provides you an opportunity to see them as a person. I think that's one of the biggest things we try to teach is the idea of it's not a sore throat in room 5 and a heart failure in room 6. Yeah. It's, you know, it's Miss Ortiz and Mr. Amanda. And, you know, they're human beings. And you, as Osler said, you know, you see the patient and not the disease. And that's one of the most important things because a sore throat can't tell a story.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sympathetic to this because this is why I started out saying that truly engaged listening, that kind of level of focus, that's difficult. So, I mean, when you walk into a room and you want to be as efficient as you can be and you want to find the right answer for the patient, right? It's understandable that you'd say, this looks like this, and let's get to that.
Of course, as you get more into your practice over the years, the more humble you get is what definitely looks like, what smells like, what sounds like may not necessarily be with what your preconceived idea was like.
Uh-huh.
I think there are so many nonverbal cues that you can basically establish with that encounter right away. Everybody that I've seen for the first time, they will always be very skeptical. They know very little about you. They've read about 4 lines on your profile on your website. But it's your job in the first 10 minutes to disarm and earn the trust. And the way you do that is, if I'm late, I'm going to go into the room and say, you know what? I'm sorry I'm late, but I had to spend an extra few minutes for the patient before you, and I'm going to spend an extra few minutes or whatever it takes to hear your story. So the way you sit down, I think if you sit down facing the patient, not the computer, give the persona of you're totally relaxed. You never look at the clock. You never look at your watch. You never look at the computer. It only takes the first 5 or 10 minutes to establish that rapport with the patient. Once you do that, I guarantee you that the information that comes out, it's valuable. It's extremely, extremely valuable.
And Doctor, your warmth, which comes through through the microphone,
would
make me want to sit and talk to you. And I can guarantee you, it wouldn't take 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Sometimes only takes a couple of minutes.
Yes, absolutely. You know, what's also interesting is that the patients are very cognizant of the fact that you're a physician and they have a very limited time.
Yep.
The first thing when it comes out of your mouth is, I think I have acid reflux. Well, Mrs. Jones, let me just back up right here. And I want to hear your story.
Yep.
So let's start from the beginning. And I often prompt them in saying, once upon a time, could you start with that?
Do you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He hits nail right on the head. I agree. Very warm physician. Understanding all those traits can be taught.
Except to radiologists.
Why? Because they're looking at technology all day?
Well, they're just a different breed.
They're sitting in the dark. Interventional radiologists, you can teach it to.
But you know, still, it's interesting that you mentioned, but that's, you know, in defense of the radiologist, and I have no big disclaimers here. But as we have sort of moved in medicine to more of a technologically based, procedure-based, instant gratification-based skill sets, we've sort of lost that art of practice of medicine, you know? Yeah. It's a different thing to come out of medical school, summa cum laude, but to deal with a patient. And I have numerous examples of outstanding physicians have extremely poor bedside manners where if the patient loses that trust in that physician, the game is over.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Dr.
True.
Humphrey's book, think she hits nail on the head there too, because she talks about how we respect and reinforce procedures.
Right.
As family physicians, our procedure is building relationships, and that's not respected or reinforced by the systems. But the reason we go into family medicine is because we enjoy the continuity relationships with our patients. The system
doesn't really reward that. Right?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. It's like, that's why you choose your specialty by which calls you. And if you need the instant gratification of a stent, you got to do interventional cardiology. But if you need the gratification of watching someone grow throughout their life, you go into family medicine. And those relationships, you start building them every single appointment. You reinforce it every single appointment. And one of the biggest things you learn about is if you don't give the patients the chance to tell their story, you will be touching a doorknob and you'll get there's one more.
Which happened. And I want to come to that.
Yeah.
Here's the thing I want to say about instant gratification, though. I'm really glad you brought that up, Amin, because I think patients are invested in the idea of that, too. Look at us the way we run off to urgent care. We want the answer. We want the fix. I don't even have a family physician,
well, this
Renee,
is one of the
because
things...
I kind of feel like I don't need it. I want the answer when I feel sick and move on.
Well, this is the thing I'm going to tell you. What family physician is, we are very fortunate, is you don't have to be sick to come to us. one of the words that Dr. Ofri uses a lot in their book is salutary.
Yeah.
And it means health-giving.
Yeah.
And the idea of we have set up a system of illness. If you're going to your doctor only when you're ill, you are not giving yourself the best chance to stay healthy. So that's the thing. That's why everyone actually should have a primary care doctor. And honestly, I'm a little biased. Everyone should have a family physician because you can bring your whole family to them. And this person can take care of you and keep you out of the hospital.
I like
from getting sick.
So, Carrie, you better go find a family physician.
Maybe I better ask Renee.
Tell me where you live. I've got a few recommendations.
All right, good. I'll
but
do
I do
that.
Want to say one thing. If we don't just talk about specialties, but we talk about basically medicine, one new paradigm that's coming into play is this idea of co-creation of healthcare services. The idea is that basically health has been looked at as something that's manufactured and provided to people. And I have a friend, Dr. Paul Batalden, who says all the time that basically health cannot be outsourced.
Yep.
Healthcare services are created, co-created with the patient and the physician and provider working together. And that's what we really need to be doing more of, regardless of the specialty that
exactly.
we're involved in.
Totally agree. So, it's not even just the physician. It's like we have pharmacy team, we have behavioral medicine. It's like you're in a situation where when you're talking about the total health of someone, you think about their function, their quality of life, and their values. It's going to be really important. I have a few patients who are currently in end stage of multiple chronic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing we talk about, I see them weekly. Most important thing we talk about is, how's life going? What's your function like? Are you doing what you want to be doing? And what are your values? Because these are going to help direct all of our next steps. And bringing up those things, talking about end-of-life decisions and those kinds of things, they come from, you know, Dr. Onfrey talks about how a patient needs compassion and trust. You can have a patient who disagrees with you, who keeps coming back. Just keeps coming back. And you're like, in your head, you like see their name on there. You're like, why do they keep coming back? And they're like, I know you and I know you know me. I trust you. And even if we don't agree, I trust you. And that's a sacred, humbling situation.
I mean, I'd love to hear you talk about this idea of values, because when people have come to you, I assume they've experienced some kind of health crisis.
Let me sort of give you a personal example. And I think that was an amazing personal example where you sort of go back to the drawing board about 8 years ago as director of the heart failure program at one of the institutions owned by Allina Hospital Systems. The CMS mandated one of the quality parameters was cutting down readmissions for heart failure, because these were the most burdensome in the society and for the CMS in terms of actual dollars. Back about 8 or 9 years ago, our hospital, along with every other hospital in the city, was looking at a 25% readmission for people with congestive heart failure. You know what that means is 1 out of 4 patients who walks out of your hospital will come back within 30 days just because they weren't quite cured.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? We spent about 2 years diving deep into the causes, and it was amazing. I could probably sit here all day and tell you exactly what all the reasons were, but one of the most humbling reasons was communication.
Yep.
How poorly we did as far as communication was concerned. 40% of the discharge instructions, either verbally or written instructions, had grievous discrepancies. Medications were duplicated. Medications were omitted. Doses were wrong. Patients were discharged out of the hospital without any follow-up appointments. The burden of responsibility was for the patients to see us back. Why would they? They just got out of the hospital. You know, there was no follow-up phone calls. There was no follow-up, hey, how are you doing? It is amazing that over the last 8 years, when we've sort of cut our readmission rate by 50%, well, maybe about 35, 40%, somewhere thereabouts, the lessons that we have learned, how important tailoring our communication for that patient when they come in your facility to seek healthcare is so important. We were doing the generic teaching, the generic education. That doesn't work for
that's
everybody.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Everybody is so unique and different.
Yeah, and you know, so this is really interesting. You know, I picked up this book and realized that there is a chapter about someone at Radboud University in the Netherlands. And it turns out that through a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation study, I'm involved with that organization. Mm-hmm. And we were just over there, and we watched how in the Netherlands they deal with these issues that you were just talking about.
Exactly.
The first thing they recognize is that social care and health care need to be better integrated.
Oh, yes.
Whereas in this country, you know, they're very separate, and it's hard actually to tease out what the, you know, connections are. But the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation wants to know, would it be better if these were better integrated? And of course, in the Netherlands, they're totally integrated. If you are a heart failure patient, you not only get treated for your heart failure, but you have a social services worker who comes to your house. You can have that person live at your house for 10 days, and that's paid for.
Yeah, and cheaper than a hospital admission.
It is. Yes. It's cheaper. And they will help you, for example, get rid of all the salt that you've been, you know, throw your beer out and your fried chicken if you need to. They will take care of a lot of things that basically make health happen outside of the hospital. So it's very interesting that, and we need to cut the readmission rates. And at HCMC, we're really looking at that too. I think we're down to maybe 15% right now.
Yeah. Right. I'd have to piggyback on both
sure.
of these because one of the things, and I think heart failure is a perfect manifestation because it's both an acute and chronic disease. And the patients we take care of in primarily North Minneapolis, and we do most of our admissions at North Memorial, the patients we take care of from our personal practice, these are folks who don't just have CHF, don't just have heart failure. They have diabetes. They have obstructive sleep apnea. And one of the things I still hits on is the social issues, the idea that, honestly, where we live, learn, work, and play has far more impact on our ability to stay healthy than even our doctors. And so you're in this situation where I'll discharge a patient from the hospital. We got them all tuned up from their heart failure, and the only place they have to eat is a food shelter. Food shelters are wonderful, but they are massively filled with salt. And salt is the most dangerous thing for a heart failure patient. Likelihood that that patient comes back is more than 25%.
So what you're really saying is you can kind of dust off your hands and say, okay, we got you through the crisis. Now go back out into that world that I don't need to know anything about. No.
Honestly, we talk about the patient-doctor relationship. They're all embedded in systems that aren't working well.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable about a book by Dr. Danielle Ofri. The book is called What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. But I asked a couple of doctors and Syl Jones, a resident on at HCMC on narrative medicine, to take a look at the book, draw some ideas and some lessons and maybe some critiques from it, and then join me for a roundtable to discuss much of what Danielle Ofri has to say. There's an anecdote here where Dr. Ofri, and I've thought about this a lot, Dr. Ofri sees a patient called Ms. Padilla, and the patient mentions that she's having pain in her shoulder and the back of her head and her stomach. And Dr. Ofri examines her, but she obviously doesn't really ask the right questions. This was a pretty big miss, Dr. Ofri concedes. And I thought I would write what happens here as Dr. Ofri describes it as Ms. Padilla is getting ready to leave the examining room. A minute later, I heard a quiet, "Doctor?" I looked up from my writing. Ms. Padilla was standing outside the office, her hand on the doorknob, getting ready to shut the door. "Can I ask you a question?" she said. "Sure," I said, putting down my pen. Ms. Padilla paused, and from under her baseball cap, she seemed to focus on a spot beyond me. Her voice grew more tentative. "Do you think?" She hesitated again, her eyes drifting as if searching for another, perhaps safer spot upon which to rest. "About the parts that hurt me, my knee, my shoulder, my heart, my stomach." Her lower lip retreated ever so slightly under her front teeth. "Do you think it's possible?" She hesitated again. "Do you think it's at all important that these are the same spots where my boyfriend shot me with a dart gun?"
Mm-hmm.
So what do you take away from that?
Well, the first thing is that her asking that question, the patient asking that question, shows that she had some trust, I think a great deal of trust, for the physician. Now, how do you achieve that kind of trust? Because, again, if you're working in a co-production or co-creation model,
mm-hmm.
you need the patient to work with you as a partner. So sometimes you miss things. You can't be perfect as a physician, and so the
patients
humility,
don't expect that.
They
obviously,
don't.
No.
They don't. But then the opening for her to say, "Do you think that this has anything to do with something that obviously did have something to do with?" Her opening to do that was caused by the doctor and the working to create the trust that would allow for that kind of conversation. So that's the first thing I take away from it, yeah. And that's important. And that's what we've been talking about, is creating the trust to allow for that. So we don't expect the doctor to know everything. And as one patient told me not too long ago, my doctor tells me what he thinks I should be doing. My body is what tells me what I can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when the two interact, then you can kind of circle around the problem and maybe zero in on what it is. And so I think that's one of the things that this particular anecdote illustrates, is the trust that allows for that.
And that trust, I mean, Syl, I think you really have it. That trust is so critical, because let's roll this back. What if that trust wasn't there? What are the chances there would have been MRIs? What are the chances there would have been x-rays? What are the chances there would have been procedures? And any procedure that we do can lead to more complications. I've had patients, and the fact that their trust was there allowed them to have that conversation and not go down those paths. I've had patients who unfortunately have gone down those paths. I've had patients who have had vague abdominal pain for almost for decades. I remember the first time when I was in residency training and I came to my preceptor and I was talking about this patient. I was like, she's had multiple surgeries and she's still having the same vague abdominal pain. She doesn't have her gallbladder anymore. She doesn't have her appendix. She's had a hysterectomy and she's still having the pain. And my wise old Dr. Walt Morgan, who was my faculty at the time, said, "Have you asked her if she's ever been sexually assaulted?" Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I just met her. And he's like, "Let's go." And he taught me how to ask the question. And it's the same way I teach my interns now. We have patients like this still. And I'm like, "Let's go." And we walk into the room. I'm like, "Ma'am, I see that you've gone through a lot here. And I'm just letting you know that this kind of pain is very real. And we've had patients in the past that have had this pain as a result of sexual abuse or sexual trauma. Has this ever been a problem for you?" And people just break into tears. Mm-hmm. They're like, "No one's ever asked me that."
Exactly.
And this is someone who's had multiple organs removed.
My gosh.
Mm-hmm. So in a situation where there's trust, you can prevent those kinds of sequela, which is the things that can happen afterwards. You can prevent those things from happening. If you create a place of trust, you might have the opportunity to get that kind of information.
I think what's also important, sort of to piggyback on both your points, is we have to give our patients a platform to establish that trust. It doesn't come, it's not taken for granted. Patients understand, and we need to reemphasize with patients that doctors and medical systems are not infallible. But if you provide them with the time, opportunity, and the personnel to sort of pour out some of those issues, and I'll give you what I do in my practice, is we have a team of heart failure nurse clinicians who basically get to know these patients on a personal level. And what I mean by personal level is when I see these patients in the hospital, the nurse clinician follows me and basically spends the extra 15, 20, 30, or however it may take to get to know these patients, understand what their living situations are, what their family situations is, and get as much information as possible and establish the trust. My business card has their number and their names on it as well. So I often tell my patients and introduce my nurse clinicians and saying, "We're part of the same team. And here's a number, here's a direct access. If you can think about something that we didn't cover on today's visit, please give us a call and let me know. If you need some more time to talk, come back to the clinic or call up the nurse clinician. We can definitely carry on this conversation." So I think giving that platform where they have that venue. It's amazing how many patients keep those cards on their refrigerator and how often their calls. Our call lines are inundated when patients talk about things like, "My vision is a problem. I can't read the pill bottles. Can you write things down in large fonts? Can you color code my instructions?" I ran into a patient a few weeks ago, couldn't read, illiterate.
Yeah.
How often do we come across that? And in our system, we assume that that's never a problem.
Well, and to have to admit that to your physician.
Exactly.
Right? You'd go to some pretty great lengths probably to want to hide that.
And it's actually dangerous for the physician not to know.
Right.
Exactly.
We have patients, you know, high blood pressure, and their blood pressure is just not in control. What do you do? Well, if you're not paying attention, you just keep throwing more medicines at them. And if they at some point take all of those, they could die.
Right.
I think one of the things I liked in Dr. Umphrey's book was that she talked about how to create that trust. And a lot of it is about giving people the space to talk. That's one of the most frightening things. When I teach medical students, they're like, if I let them talk, it's going to go on forever.
She says that in the book, mm-hmm. right? The doctors believe that
too. That's the biggest fear. And none of the data bears that out. Right. All of the data bears out that if you give the patient the time to tell their story and you give them the space and you listen with the intent of hearing, not the intent of responding. You listen to hear, not to respond. If you do that, your patient will have the time to tell your story and build the trust that you need in order to move forward in that therapeutic alliance.
Renee, did you see the research that Dr. Ofri talks about mm-hmm. how quickly mm-hmm. physicians mm-hmm. interrupt?
12 seconds.
12 seconds.
Yeah. When we've been talking about this at HCMC a lot. It's a little bit insulting to patients that doctors have this presumption that patients are going to rattle on for so long.
I know.
When really it only takes a couple of minutes sometimes to get to. And we're not talking about the chief complaint. We're talking about the story.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's what you really need is you need the whole story. And it doesn't take that long. Yeah. But I constantly run into residents who, with folded arms, will look at me and say, where am I going to find the time to listen to a patient who
really?
Wants to tell me? Yeah.
What's your answer to that?
It's if you do it skillfully, it doesn't take that long.
Yeah. And the video reviews that we do, for mm-hmm. them, one of the best things that you do is you can hold it up and say, okay, do you see where they cut them off right here? And let's see what happened as a result of that. And they're like, oh, they just went back and tried to keep telling it. So you cutting mm-hmm. them off actually prolonged the time that you were there.
Mm-hmm.
For our teaching purposes, video reviews are critical because they can see their own actions right there. And when you tell them that they cut people off, they won't hear it. But when they see themselves, they're like, oh, my God, I just cut them off.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, what could you have done differently? And then we move forward.
As you're listening to this roundtable, I'd love to hear from you on Twitter. When you see your doctor, do you feel like you have his or her full attention? And if you were going to give some lovingly constructive criticism to your doctor about communication, what would you say? Tweet me about that at Carrie, KerriMPR. I mean, I wanted to ask you, you reminded me about what Dr. Ofri said about the way doctors think about non-compliant patients, basically right. patients who aren't following advice and how mysterious this seems to physicians. You've just given a couple examples of why that doesn't happen. Are doctors understanding this better, that just because you go home with a bunch of instructions or the doctor said you have to do this, a lot of patients can't or won't?
That is so true. It's very easy. Doctors, remember, sort of have to go back to the journey through medical school, are always supposed to be objective. They're supposed to think in boxes.
Makes sense.
They are right. The curers. They're the pill pushers. And remember, there's also a certain level of an ego that comes along with it and saying, I am entrusted with that responsibility to cure, so I'm going to always be right. If you have that dogmatic approach towards any patient's medical care, you're going to get burned some point in time in your life.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I can tell you this is so important that you absolutely have to be non-dogmatic, non-judgmental. And this phrase about the patient is non-compliant, in my mind, this is only just a minority of patients that you deal with could be non-compliant. And even those patients will usually have some sort of an underlying reason. Yeah. Either there's going to be depression, anger, physical pain, side effects.
Yeah.
Very often, we are the quickest one to say, well, guess what? This is not written in my PDR.
Exactly.
This is not going to be part of the side effects.
Yeah.
But we're now learning with genomics.
Yeah.
That every patient's response to a medication is going to be very different.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, I always walk in with the presumption saying, what you hear from the patient is always right. It's mm-hmm. your job to figure out yeah. how they're right and how you can
Boy,
help them.
Boy, is that yeah. a paradigm shift, yeah. though, and the way it used to be.
That's what keeps you humble.
It is. Yeah, it really
is. It's the reality of the fact that they're the ones living their life. They're the ones carrying their genome. And honestly, our job is primarily to guide them and give them the choices and find out what it is.
But Renee, be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you see patients with several chronic diseases, including diabetes, mm-hmm. you're human if you think if they would just give up the fried chicken, we could get the, you know.
Well, Carrie, I'm very fortunate in that in my long career, one of the things that I had to do was lose a lot of weight. I used to weigh over 252 pounds, and that was over 8 years ago. I was 10 inches wider at the waist and obese.
Wow.
And one of the hardest things in the world is to lose weight. And honestly, I'm a doctor. I have every single possible resource. And I have people who know that the cheapest thing for them to do is to go to McDonald's and feed their whole family. Mm-hmm. How are they going to lose weight? Mm-hmm. I have people who, I know that one of the biggest, most important things to lose weight is that you have 7 hours of sleep a night. I have people who have to stay up to feel that they need to protect their family. And they're not getting more than 2 hours of sleep at a time. How are they going to lose weight?
I have three jobs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. or two jobs, yeah. three jobs. I have patients right. that have three jobs. When are you supposed to sleep? And so these things, when we talk about, you know, the non-compliant patient, these people, our patients are living their lives. And we have to understand where they're coming from and help them live it as healthy as possible from what they're capable of doing.
And since we're being not, you know, we're being disclosing, I went through exactly the same thing. I lost 80 pounds. I was a diabetic, labeled with a capital D on my forehead. My grandfather was a diabetic. His grandfather was a diabetic. I was told I was going to be a diabetic the rest of my life. I ballooned up to over 300 pounds. I used the medical profession to try to find out what I should be doing. But what I found out was the medical profession knows medicine, but it doesn't know me.
Yep, right. Exactly.
And I learned to figure out what kind of diet I need in order to lose the 80 pounds that I wound up losing.
You know, Sel, I think that's such an important point. And Renee, to your point is when we stigmatize patients
yep.
by telling them that, guess what, you're non-compliant, you don't want to quit smoking, mm-hmm. you want to eat unhealthy, what we are basically doing is shutting off doors for all future communications and their ability to ask for help.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Got to get down to the bottom of things, saying you can gently coach them, you can gently coax them, you can gently suggest them, you can provide them with resources, and they'll be definitely more apt to use some of them, some of those resources. You know, it's interesting. We talk about salt for heart failure, and I sort of keep gravitating back because that's what my experience has been
sure.
with heart failure. And a lot of patients that we stigmatize saying, guess what, you don't want to know, you don't want to manage your heart failure just because you eat a ton of salt. Once or twice education, personalized dose education, those same people come back, never, ever, ever getting back to the hospital. I've known patients for 5 years. They've been in the hospital six times the year before and none for the last 5 years, just because the truth, the reality, and that personalized advice sank in, is reinforced, reemphasized, and rewarded by positive gratification.
You know what's interesting, though, to hear you all talk about this is, as you know, with where healthcare policy
yeah.
is headed, yeah. even with Obamacare and whatever comes next after that, there is more responsibility, more burden put on the patients themselves, too. This is what I think I hear you saying. So when you say we're co-creating mm-hmm. healthcare, there is more of the expectation mm-hmm. that the patient will also manage their own healthcare to bring costs down. And in some ways, I think that discussion doesn't fully take into account a lot of what you've said today.
It's true. And there is this concept called burden of treatment, which people talk about a lot, too. It's not just the cost, but it's like all the instructions you have to follow mm-hmm. that the doctor gives you. And it's very difficult to follow all those instructions. That's why what you have to do is find a physician and or a healthcare provider who can help you find the right thing for you and then simplify it.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, if you ask me what I had for breakfast this morning, I had a protein shake. I've had a protein shake for breakfast for 2.5 years now. That protein shake has some things in it that allow my own body to generate more of its own insulin, which I was told basically I didn't have anymore, but to generate its own insulin so that I could stay at a normal level. And I've stopped eating carbs altogether. So that was important for me. Now, I wouldn't prescribe that for everybody, but I had to find that working with a series of different healthcare providers to be able to find what worked for me. And that's what I think patients need to do.
Yeah. And one of the things, you know, that I think Dr. Ofri mentions, and I really appreciate she does, is that both the patients and the doctors want this to work, that we do. But if you keep hearing the stories that we're talking about, one of the most important things is time. I mean, we do our best to train our residents to go out and be family physicians in the world who are compassionate, caring, empathetic. We teach them all the skills, and then we dump them into a system that says 15-minute visits. And it doesn't matter how well you're trained if the pressures on the system are both against the physician developing with the relationship with the patient. You have to go the extra mile. You have to actually, you're late to every appointment because the system is set up so that you can't spend the 30, 40 minutes that you need to spend to create that time to discuss the diet, to ask them about where they live, learn, work, and play, to engage in a real therapeutic alliance in a way that you're listening and then developing, co-creating health with your patient. That takes time.
You know, Renee, just to add on to your point, and I would so totally agree with you, what is a little disheartening is the fact that how important we as providers and the payer community puts on patient communication. Now, if you look at the HCAHPS score, which is basically scoring what the patient scores their hospital stay. So it's
patient satisfaction
is based on 18 questions, mm-hmm. where physician communication is only one of the 18. It has equal weightage to that breakfast that you got through the catering service or how quiet your room was at 2 o'clock in the morning and how good your housekeeping service was when they cleaned your bathroom. So physician communication has the same weightage on that, and that's a super, super small percent. All of that is right now going to be 4% of Medicare reimbursement starting in 2019. Mm-hmm. Patient communication will fall into like 0. You can add as many zeros as you want ahead of that number. It is going to be super small.
So you're saying that the system does not emphasize or reward this
enough?
No, it does not.
As a family doc, we can work for 3, 5, 10 years to keep someone healthy and out of the hospital who has all the cardiac risks in the world. Mm-hmm. We keep them out of the hospital. For that full length of time, we still won't get paid as much as the cardiologist who throws in a stent and sees the patient for one day. So I kept them out of the hospital for 10 years.
Right.
And even the accumulated amount of time that I see them, I won't get paid as much as that one stent that gets put in at the hospital.
Now, this is what everyone is saying about the system being broken. So from a political and policy standpoint, we need to bring this to the attention of people who make these policies. And I think that there are some changes that are occurring, although we've had an election that's disrupted that a little bit. But I hope that as we begin to move forward, we can consider some of the cost-saving things that occur when we're rewarding you for keeping your patient out of the hospital for 10 years or we're actually paying doctors to actually have conversations with their patients and to listen to their patients, being the chief listening officer, which is what I aspire to be.
Yeah. So I want to close with your best advice to the patient. This is a unique opportunity for me and for our listeners to hear from a doctor to say the most effective way you can communicate and build this relationship is...
For patients, it's one of the things where what I'd say is find someone that you feel that you can open to and open to them. And if they cut you off, just like Dr. Orphy says, say, hold on a second. I actually have more. And you know what? As a doctor, we'll take that. We're like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Let me know what you want me to know. And tell your full story. And don't be afraid to. And if you find that this person is not someone you're comfortable with, we've trained a ton of doctors. There's someone out there for you.
You have a lot of choices, right?
Yeah.
So what would you say?
I don't know if you guys remember, but there was a time when they actually said that if patients came into your office and they had a list of symptoms, that was a bad thing.
Oh, that's not about, that's awesome.
I remember when they used to tell doctors that, you know, that shows that they're really preoccupied with their. I think the best advice I would give any patient is that before you go see your doctor, you spend some time thinking about what your mm-hmm. story is.
Yep, tell your story.
And you can even script it to some degree. Make sure that you outline the things that you really are interested in. Make sure you say what you want to achieve in your treatment plan, and then ask the doctor how he or she feels about that. You can get a doctor's opinion oftentimes about what they think, but what I'm really curious about often is, how do they feel about the story that you're telling?
It's really good. Hey, thank you all for an excellent roundtable. Amin, Renee, Syl, thank you.